Hello, everyone. This is M.R. Rangaswamy with Indiaspora. Today I'm joined by Ajay Raju. He's the CEO and chairman of Dilworth Paxson. It's a white shoe law firm out of Philadelphia, extremely well known in the country. We'll get to that in a moment. He also runs the Raju Foundation with his wife, Pamela, and we'll be talking quite a bit about that as well. Raju has been in the Philly area for a long time and has promoted Philadelphia as a city, a destination, and a place of life. He is also sits on the board of several institutions nationally as well as in Pennsylvania. And he serves on boards of the Greater Philadelphia Chamber of Commerce, Comcast NBC's Joint Diversity Council, the Philadelphia Museum of Art, and very, very active both socially, politically, and in a philanthropic way as well. So, Ajay, welcome to our show.
Thank you, Amar. That's quite an introduction.
Thanks. So let's get started with you. You were born in India in Bhopal, and then you make your way to Philly. So just take us through, how did you come from India to the United States, and what your early life was like in the U.S.?
Well, it's a typical immigrant story. Parents of Indian descent decide for greater opportunity to take the family cross oceans, and not knowing what to expect once they cross the ocean, you know, that sort of a courageous immigrant spirit brought them over to Philadelphia, because that's where we were sponsored from. And once we came here in early 80s, we stayed here with the exception of 2 years in New York when I worked at Weil Gotshal in New York. For the most part, we've been products of Philadelphia.
Fantastic. And how was it growing up? You come from Bhopal to Philadelphia. That's quite a marked change. So how did you feel, and how was school like, and so forth?
You know, it's interesting. When I first came here, my first day in school, the teacher wrote my name on the blackboard, and a young lady in the back of the class read my name out loud, and I can still remember it as though it was yesterday. And she said, A.J. Raju, what a cool name. And as I stood there, M.R., and I realized, I was conscious of the fact that Ajay left Bhopal for Philadelphia. Philadelphia was a blank canvas, and I had the opportunity to paint something that did not just lose its luster after casting a brief spell, but I could at least paint an abstract painting once I got here. And at that moment, for the most part, I did not correct her pronunciation of my name. I allowed Ajay to become AJ, and that mindset, it was a pivotal moment, at least for me, from a consciousness standpoint, because I knew that Ajay was born in India, but that AJ would be made in America. And I think my life consistently has been that. I'm proud of my Indian heritage, but I'm also extremely proud of the opportunities that I have received as an American with Indian descent, and the specific heritage that, quite frankly, traces civilizations.
Fantastic, fantastic. I had a very similar experience as well. My long name, Madhavan Rangaswamy, became M.R. Rangaswamy in the U.S. I view that very similarly.
Although I will say, M.R., most people call me A.J., but they're also equal amount call me A.J., and I respond to both. As long as it's not a curse word, I'm okay with it.
So where did you go to college, and how did you become a lawyer?
You know, I went to Temple University, undergrad, as well as law school. Like most good Indian kids at the time in the 80s, I was expected to go to medical school. And I remember, you know, I was active very much in student government and Indian American political activism at an early age. The Indian community, especially in Philadelphia, gave me a platform and allowed me to at least to be a leader within the community, and they sort of shaped and molded me at an earlier age. And my interests were social advocacy and leadership, but my academic focus was pre-chem, at least chemistry and biochemistry, and going into pre-med. Until I realized I had to take my MCATs, and I did not want to be a doctor. And I remember my grandfather at the time who passed away thinking, what's wrong with the boy? Is he not smart enough? Maybe we should send him some tutors. But because at least law was not something in the 80s that Indian families pushed their kids towards. And I fell into it as an alternate only because people around me said, if you don't want to become a doctor, there are a lot of things you can do as a lawyer. And they were the ones who gently nudged me towards law. Instead of MCATs, I took LSATs, and rest is history.
So that was quite a switch to law. And I know part of your growing up, you got involved in political campaigns and such. How did you get drawn to that part of life?
You know, I noticed, especially in the Philadelphia community, you had many Indian Americans who were politically active. When I say many, I'm talking about, actually, I should not say many, it was really a handful. So you had a small group of oligopoly of folks who had a heavy thumb on the scale of influence. These were sort of prominent doctors or business people. And they would raise minimum amount of money from the larger Indian community, host events, private events with mainstream politicians. And once I dug deeper into it, I noticed that there was no ask, that you had these fundraisers, you had a handful who had in their offices a mainstream politician's photo along with a brown face, but there was nothing to really show for it for community. There wasn't much need in the beginning, although our biggest issues were, our larger issues were glass ceiling, occasional violence. Of course, this was pre-9/11, and for the most part, if you looked at the average, almost everybody came with either a degree or some specific opportunity. So the social needs were not as great as they are today for the Indian, larger Indian community, both from an upside opportunity as well as a need. And but it occurred to me that there ought to be an ask. If we're going to give something, if we're going to be a block, whether it is potential voters or potential aggregators or bundlers of money for mainstream politicians, that there ought to be a two-way street. So I got involved in it mainly because I thought there was a gap, and I wanted to fill it. I was young, but I was lucky enough to have adults around me who gave me a platform, did not treat me as though I was young, but they treated me as equals, and off I went.
And what was looking back at that time, what was one of the memorable campaigns that you participated in?
You know, I think it was not as much, I would not say memorable campaigns, yeah. Because I think for me, mainstream politicians come and go. It was really building the infrastructure, the base, with a handful of progressive Indians at all levels, and then developing the Indian, back then it was called the Indian American Political Action Committee. And it was the precursor to what we have now as a center PAC. It was a progressive, business-oriented PAC. It created an established infrastructure for cross-communication between at least our community and mainstream politics, whether it's city council level or state level, legislative level or governor or even federal level. So it was an early springboard of making sure that the community was just not a stop during election cycle, but instead it should be an ongoing hub for politicians and policymakers to see who we are and to sort of have a platform that articulated both the positives and also articulated the needs from a policy standpoint that our community wanted. So I don't know if there's one thing as much as building that infrastructure, that communication pipeline.
And so I'm sure, you know, you have to kind of pay your dues as a lawyer and start in the firm as a rookie and so forth. How did you end up at Reed Smith? What took you to that firm?
Well, I think as most people, you know, you develop your you hone your skills, you hone your trade. I was known as a pretty good lawyer and pretty good drafts person, and then I got really lucky at a young age with a nice book of business. In our world, having a book of business makes you portable and makes you attractive. It becomes a magnet, at least for other platforms. And I had for a young associate, I had a sizable book of business, which was attractive, obviously, to many firms. At the time when I joined Reed Smith, there was a strong interest in developing an India practice. That was the initial attraction that Reed Smith as a platform had with me. I was dabbling a little bit with helping large U.S. companies enter the Indian market, and vice versa, Indian companies moving up here. And I had developed a niche reputation as somebody who had the ability to at least parachute down, resolve crisis for folks, U.S. companies that are in India, or at least, on the other hand, as well as take advantage of opportunities that cross-border transactions were creating at the time. So that's what made me attractive to them, and what attracted me to Reed Smith platform was that it's a global, powerful, global firm with just a deep and great culture, and that drew me to that firm.
And then, of course, obviously, more recently, the big switch as CEO and chairman of Dilworth Paxson. I mean, such a renowned firm with such a heritage and a pedigree law firm in the Northeast. How did that come about?
You know, MR, I think I'm at a point in my life. I'm 45. I feel like Bruno Mars has now sang, halftime is over, and my second portion of my life has just begun. So I'm more focused on legacy these days. And when I was focused on at least past 2-3 years, when I did an audit of my life and where I'm going, what will be my legacy, what will be the footprints that most people remember, one constant theme that came back was my region, Philadelphia, mm-hmm. With which I'm in love, and obviously I have a deep sense of appreciation for this region, for it has made me in many ways. So I wanted a career that did not have conflict with all of the other interests that I have, whether they're philanthropic, art-based, or cultural, societal, or business. And I wanted a life where everything you do, it turned into an impact philanthropic venture, whether it's business, whether it is law, whether it is philanthropy, all of it had an impact. And that impact I wanted focused on the Philadelphia region. And there was no really better firm other than Dilworth Paxson that sort of captured that zeitgeist that I was feeling for myself. And that's what drew me to Dilworth at the time when they were trying to recruit me as well. It sort of made sense for me.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, you know, I have to commend you. You know, you have broken the glass ceiling, the ceiling that exists for most immigrants in any country you go to. And so did you get a sense of that, or was it just they accepted you as, you know, one of them, as a local, you know, native? How was your experience in that case?
You know, it's interesting. I don't think when we were having these discussions with Dilworth Paxson, my immediate team and I don't think my Indianness was a focal point for them, partly because the regional firm doesn't have international roots, and that was not the focus. As, for example, at least when I went to Reed Smith, the fact that I potentially could build an India practice was a focus of conversation. My conversation with Dilworth folks constituted of was primarily the love for my region, all the activities we had done with the Raju Foundation and initiatives like the Citizen, the Germination Project, why I cared so deeply about the region, what I expected to do in this region the next 20 years. And I think that was the part of the conversation. But the bulk of the conversation was my ongoing conversations about why law should be, there should be more innovation in the practice of law. And I think they were attracted to that notion because I had done an interview with Professor Lipson at Temple Law School, and where I talked about the need for law firms to break the old model and create innovative platforms to create new sources of revenue. And they were more interested in that. Where is the innovation conversation going, and how can that be applied to an old traditional white shoe firm like Dilworth Paxson?
Fantastic. So tell me a little bit more about the firm, how large, what kind of law do you guys practice, and so forth. That would be very interesting to hear about.
It's a typical general practice, large law firm, 280 or so folks that we have within Dilworth, and it's primarily headquartered in Philadelphia, but we have strong and large presence in New Jersey, Harrisburg, New York, D.C. It's a regional firm. And it is historical, at least for our region, MR. The namesake itself is Richardson Dilworth, Richardson Dilworth was is a big name in the Philadelphia area. Our city of Philadelphia used to be used to have 7-1 Republican advantage at a time. I'm Republican, by the way. At least today I'm an independent, but at least I was registered Republican most of my life. But at least in Philadelphia, we had a very corrupt history of the Republican Party controlling it. And then Richardson Dilworth and Joe Clark, progressives, come on board and break the one-party system. And unfortunately today is, again, a one-party system of 7-1 Democrats. But the city deserves, at least owes a debt of gratitude to the progressive work of Richardson Dilworth. And it's reflected in all of the accolades that the former mayor and the late mayor gets. But it's beyond that. The Brown versus Board of Education, the seminal case that broke the back of segregation in this country, was written by Secretary Coleman, who was then an associate at Dilworth Paxson, eventually becoming a leader in our firm. He eventually becomes the Secretary of Transportation under Gerald Ford. And if you, the first a class action lawsuit was invented and created at Dilworth Paxson, Harold Cohn. The first planned community work Levittown ever done in the country was done at Dilworth Paxson. So it has a deep legacy and a rich history, where in many cases the history of Philadelphia unfolded within Dilworth Paxson, and also many of the innovation in terms of areas of law, whether it's segregation, breaking down segregation, or whether it is class action or planned communities, all of that work has embedded roots within Dilworth Paxson. So it has a rich history, but we're most focused on not being a firm where history evolved, but being a firm where future is invented. And today, while we have a deep anchor of a rich tradition, our continual focus is how do we now create a new era of innovation in the legal field.
Fantastic. So we'll be taking a short break now, and we'll come back, Ajay, in a moment to talk about your foundation and all the other interesting things you're doing.
Sounds good, Mehmer.
Hello again, everyone. This is M.R. Rangaswamy with Indiaspora Radio. I'm back here with Ajay Raju, the CEO and chairman of Dilworth Paxson. So, Ajay, let's talk a little bit about the Raju Foundation that your wife Pamela and you run. Very fascinating when I was reading up on it. You have something called the Germination Project. Take us through your thinking of starting the foundation and what this Germination Project is all about?
Well, the Germination Project, it's a long-term 50-year bet in the region, bet for the region, the Philadelphia region. The idea, MR, is how do we recruit the best and the brightest within a region, inject into them a sense of civic commitment, and then deploy them back into service for those who are not as privileged as the top percentile folks who have both resources, money, knowledge, intelligence, et cetera. And the reason for that long-term bet is critical for Philadelphia region. You know, we're a tale of two cities, MR. For the bottom 60% in our region, this is a city that leads the country in child poverty. Two of the poorest congressional districts in the country are located within walking distance of Center City. We have a culture of public corruption, institutionalized inequality in our region. Our school system is broken, has been broken for decades. The median household income in Philadelphia is $35,000, whereas the national median household average is $50,000. We don't have a sufficiently trained workforce. That's what the 60% in our region experience. But then there's the other city. That's what the 40% experience. We are also a region that is known for the largest concentration of wealth in the country. So you have, on one hand, large poverty, at the same time, largest concentration of wealth. $8 billion of construction happened within walking distance of Philadelphia last year. We had the largest segment of universities in our region. We grant more degrees than any other city in the country, even more than Boston. Mm-hmm. Our healthcare system is the best in the world, with the University of Penn's Penn Health, Jefferson, and many others anchoring it. CHOP, the country's top children's hospital, is located here. So when you look at for the 40%, the elastic potential is above. I'm not just discovered Facebook, and I have a person on Facebook who keeps sending me these quotes, and I'm a big fan of inspirational quotes. And I saw one. It was a bird sitting on a branch, and the quote said, "A bird sitting on a weak branch is not concerned about the branch collapsing, because she is confident in the strength of her own wings." The Germination Project was created for the 40% who have social mobility, who have the power of flight, but who are also deeply concerned about the city underneath them crumbling down. And the idea was to engage them, make sure they don't leave the region, but instead dedicate both their philanthropy and business and other efforts in improving the lives of the 60%, especially considering that for each decade that passes by in Philadelphia, their lives get worse and worse.
Right. And so I think as part of the Germination Project, Ajay, you have, four different initiatives?
Yeah, so it's not the germination. So within the Germination Project, the idea is to recruit talent early. So as 10th graders, we sort of have this, similar to the Rhodes Scholarship, we identified germination fellows. We just started it. 15 fellows were inducted at a big gala at the Union League with 523 people attending, with Senator Casey and Senator Toomey as the gala chairs. And those 15 kids will be the early product. Imagine an ecosystem like an NBA. They're the sort of early roster of the NBA draft. You know, you have the players coming in. And then they are being mentored and coached by the existing leaders within the Philadelphia community. And they will do their service, and that mentoring happens through these service initiatives. So just to give you one example, MR, one of the initiatives is called the healthcare initiative. 50 years from now, healthcare will still be an issue in Philadelphia as it is today. Jefferson Health System, one of our largest health systems in our region, is our lead institutional partner. What that means is we take with an existing nonprofit that serves the lowest, poorest members of our community, we take a mobile healthcare approach to taking preventive healthcare to those who are off the grid of healthcare. So we have, you know, the bottom 60 that I talk about, they're not doing preventive care, but they become eventually burdens to healthcare, not because they want to, but because they either don't have access or they don't have knowledge or they can't afford it. What we're doing is we're taking that fight to them. And you can imagine the same initiative on the financial literacy, sustainability. It's a ground-up approach of taking the top 1% and then deploying them into the community so that we can have incremental change that is long-lasting. So it's not a short-term idea, but instead it's sort of teaching everybody how to fish and then encouraging everybody to fish themselves, but having the few fishermen up top going around to the community just to sort of spread the gospel of fishing so that it becomes a new religion in our region.
Oh, that's great. So just coming back to the Raju Foundation, you do other work as well there, right? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, there are four legs to the chair for the Raju Foundation. One is the Germination Project, about which we just discussed. Second is a project called the Philadelphia Citizen, which we founded, and now it is run and it has additional funding from others as well, but it is now run by one of the smartest guys in our region, Jeremy Nowak, who used to run a large foundation in our region. And the editor is Larry Platt, former editor of Daily News in Philadelphia, as well as Philadelphia Magazine, and a pretty large staff that runs it. It's a solutions-based journalism experience. The idea is to, instead of having a snapshot of problems and description of it, but instead talk about the solutions that work for issues facing a region like Philadelphia. It's highly respected journalism experiment, and we were lucky enough to have folks like Larry Platt and Jeremy Nowak take leadership of it. The next one is called what we call the INT Exchange. I know that I have roots in India and I have connections in India and folks of Indian descent. So the idea there is to create a cultural trade route between Philadelphia and places like India or Silicon Valley or London, where Indians are, where we use the arts and culture and eds and meds, education institutions and medical institutions in Philadelphia as the new spice. The goal is to create these cross linkages and have so that there's no new business and new exchange that occurs. That's what we call the inter-exchange. And the last portion is, you know, we support the World Affairs Council, their millennial membership program is named after me. But the idea there is to sort of engage a new set of generation within the Philadelphia area and the region to be more global thinkers so that we can take Philadelphia to the world and bring world to Philadelphia. But it's to engage new foot soldiers with both the interest as well as the experience to lead this region in a global manner.
Fantastic. I'm intrigued by your quote. You said, "I do not have enough fingers to count the number of boards I serve on." Can you tell us a little bit about some of them and what made you kind of be so prolific?
Well, look, I don't. I'm not in the business of serving, just joining and adding new board assignments to the resume. But I have a hard time saying no. That's part of it. And also, you know, I would love to drink the ocean if I could. So in Philadelphia area, whether it's the Philadelphia Museum of Art, whether it's the Philadelphia Orchestra, the Chamber of Commerce and the World Affairs Council, you know, the Philadelphia Citizen and all the other things that we have, it's hard to say no. These are some of the world's best institutions. Philadelphia Museum of Art by far is one of the greatest institutions in the world. It has the largest collection of Duchamps, the largest collection of Renoir, you know, one of the largest collections of art, period. And it is the anchor for a very robust arts culture in the world. But that's where it all starts, the Philadelphia Museum of Art. So our slogan is "It starts here," and it's actually very apropos because if you think about within walking distance, largest collection of art, it's the Philadelphia region, along with New York, Vienna, Paris, London. But Philadelphia is one of the top five cities in the world within walking distance where you can experience the best in arts and culture. And when you get invited to serve a board like the Philadelphia Museum of Art, it's hard to say no. And I feel the same way about the orchestra, which is the world-renowned and probably the most important orchestra at one point. So in any event, Tomozo, all of the boards that do have my hands on all had to do with one thing, one common element, which is the region and making this region great and global.
So I have to ask you this question. Now that you're so involved in the community, you're such an ambassador for the community and a cheerleader, is anything political on the cards?
Well, I don't know if running for elected office is in the cards, but I will say this: you don't have to be Homeland Security to say something if you see something. I think there are multiple ways one can serve a community. You can be a business person, you can be an engaged philanthropist, you can be a social worker. Of course, elected office is another vehicle. It affords you a nice platform to make change, but at least for the time being, MR, I'm content with the work that we're doing within the Roger Foundation and my role within Dilworth Law Firm, which, quite frankly, has a nice heavy thumb on the scale of influence in our region, where I can at least make changes wearing that uniform.
You must be, I don't know how many hours you get to sleep every day with all the activities you have. How do you find time to relax, and how do you switch off from all the things you do?
MR, one of the first things I learned in the U.S. is that you can take a lot of credit for other people's work, so I don't really do most of the work. I have great people who do the work. I just get to take the credit for it. So in terms of how do I relax and what do I do to switch off, a nice dinner with engaged and engaged conversation with a lively group is relaxation. You know, the conversation may be politics, business, et cetera, but for me, that's relaxing. Two, I sometimes just stare at the TV. You know, I watch television and stare at trees and just zone out. That's my relaxation when I find time with just myself and thoughts. Or sometimes, of course, I crave company of intellectuals, and I'm blessed to be surrounded by many in our region.
Great. I recently read, Ajay, that you have two obsessions, your hair gel and your weight. I thought that was fascinating. Is there any other secret about you that nobody knows?
Most of my family hates my hairstyle and my obsession with it. But so I think I make fun of it myself. So before people can make fun of it, but you know, but in some circles, people will actually say it's a stylish hairstyle.
Yeah.
Except my wife, who doesn't agree. as far as my weight is concerned, yes, it's I have a sugar addiction and I have to constantly monitor how much I eat and how much I do to work out. I used to be an athlete. I had a pretty good body, and I'm trying to make sure I maintain it as I get older. As far as other secrets that I had, I don't know if I'm a pretty boring guy. I think for the most part, I'm interested in really smart people, and I live off of their genius and try to be part of that ecosystem that I've created for myself, where I've filled it with really engaged and smart people. So I'm a sponge, if you will. So that's probably the only other secret, that I don't really have any talent, but I do have a native curiosity for what's beyond the horizon. And for me, the horizon is not a limit, but merely an invitation. And the talent I've accumulated over the years is to attract those who have that curiosity to sort of explore the horizon and beyond, and then piggyback on their strength and make a living off of it. So in some ways a sponge, but a great fan of interesting and folks who are smart and capable.
Terrific, Ajay. It's been a fantastic half an hour with you. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Enjoyed it, Amar. Thank you so much.
In Diaspora Radio is produced by Monica Patel. Theme music is by our very own Rina Ismail. The interlude music is by Jahan Shah. So long, everyone.